The balmy California breeze is offering natural air conditioning to the living room of the home of Ann Seymour, where we are to chat with a lady whose career took a giant step forward back in Chicago not too many years ago. Ann Seymour, it's nice of you to invite us in.
Well, it's very nice of you both to come. Thank you.
You starred as Mary Marlin, didn't you?
I went to Chicago to do Grand Hotel with Donna Meachie, and I did that before I did Mary Marlin.
I see. Well, where did you come from?
Came from New York City, where I was born. And I had done some radio in Cincinnati at Station WLW, and I went there greener than the grass. But I did do an awful lot of shows there in 3 months. I was there when Fats Waller was there, you know, and the Rhythm Boys, and it was pretty exciting.
And was that the beginning of your professional career?
No, I'd been on the stage before then.
What were you doing on the stage?
Trying to act. No, I went to the American Laboratory Theater School and studied with Maria Uspenskaya, the great Russian actress, and Richard Boleslavsky, who was the great Russian director-writer. And they became wonderful friends of mine, thank goodness. And then I went from the lab to my first Broadway play, which didn't hit Broadway, with called The Husband Habit, Grace George, Melvin Douglas, and Walter Connolly. Mm-hmm. But there was a spring tryout, but that was the beginning. And then I played Season with Ethel Barrymore in School for Scandal, and I did Repertory in Boston. But that was not what I would call a living, you know, even in those days. So I thought, what is this thing called radio? And I truthfully say it was 1932. I did Grand Hotel 1933, and I took over Mary Marlin from Joan Blaine in 1936.
And so you brought sound effects with you, all this...
this sounds like in a sanctum.
Let's explain to our listeners exactly what this is. We're not too far from the UCLA Medical Center, is that right?
The UCLA Medical Center, which is has an emergency ward, which I think explains. And I think something must have happened somewhere, because they're really pretty violent right now.
A lot of sirens.
And then we have a fire department, and it's Wilshire Boulevard in Westwood. The home of the movie theaters. And I'm sorry about this, but there's really nothing
I can do.
Wilshire Boulevard is torn up, too, we might
say. That's right. We found that out on the way over.
Getting here is kind of a hassle.
Well, we just took a detour in our visit to your career. So now where are we? Radio was very fascinating.
Oh, radio was fascinating. Uh-huh. And of course, at that time, and I bet you don't know why, in the 30s and early 40s, 75% of all dramatic radio came from Chicago. This is one of my favorite little quiz questions.
All right. Let me try to answer.
I bet you're smart.
Because of the time difference across the country, they did.
No.
I failed a trivia question from Ann.
It's a trivia question.
All right.
No, the reason was that Chicago was in the center, was near overnight from Cincinnati, Detroit, Battle Creek, name me some more big places where they had sponsors. You know, all of the sponsors could come, get on the train at night and get off the train in Chicago.
Oh, I see.
And they had much more control, the sponsors did, over programs then than they have now on television shows. You know, it was Oxydol's own Ma Perkins.
Right.
And we were Ivory Snow, Mary Marlin was. And when I did Grand Hotel, it was Dreskin, which was a new product made by the people who made Italian Balm. And they were there constantly. I don't think they knew very much, some of them. Some
but they
of them
were
did.
Always very much involved in the program, weren't they?
Oh, very much so.
Fan mail to a sponsor would probably get more response then than fan mail to a network today.
I can't answer that, but I think it's very probable because they had... I think they cared more about public relations between the product. I mean, today I don't think a sponsor can say, I want to sponsor Police Story, for instance. The network says, here's what you're going to sponsor.
Yeah.
Because I know there's a great deal of talk about the violence, and people are now writing sponsors. The violence, I mean, on television.
On TV.
Which I think is too bad. I mean, there's so much more that could be done, should be done.
Yeah. How did you get from that first radio job to Chicago?
Well, that's funny. I my first job in Cincinnati, I got $75 a week. And my title was leading lady in a radio stock company, and I didn't know what that meant. And for 2 weeks, I really didn't do anything. I did a show called Tale of Terror twice a week, and I think that they looked at, who is this woman who's being paid $75? Because it was depression, you see.
That was fantastic salary.
With a huge salary in those days. And they discovered it was me. Mm-hmm. So from that moment on, I used to open the station with a gossip column from Hollywood. I did the first commercial for Crosley Radio on radio. And I did Shakespeare, and I dubbed in the speaking voices for the singers. And I think I was doing around 40 or 50 shows a week. And they decided that I was getting too much money. So they cut me to $50, and I left. And I went back to New York.
And you went back to New York.
And then in New York, my agent there, Briscoe and Goldsmith, sent me to audition for Grand Hotel. And I went to Chicago, having gotten the job, wondering whether I was going to play the part that Garbo did in the picture or Crawford. And I didn't know the setup at all. And it was whatever the part was, I played the lead, and Don Amici played the man.
It was
man.
A running repertoire
anthology.
Company.
Yes, like very much so. Fibber McGee and Molly were on it, and Tyrone Power, Les Tremaine, Olin Soule.
Remember a gal by the name of Rita Ascott?
Yes, indeed I do. How is she? Do you know her?
I know her. She says hello.
Oh, give her my love. She's a darling.
She was on Grand Hotel for a while.
Yes, and I think she was on Mary Marlin, too.
I believe she was.
I think she was. So many people.
There were a lot of Mary Marlins over the years, I think.
That is a sort of interesting saga, because it began with Joan Blaine playing Mary Marlin, and I played, what was my name? Sally Gibson, the bad girl, the villain in the piece. And I did that for about 2 years, and then they took Grand Hotel off for the summer, and I went to Europe, so I left Mary Marlin. And when I came back, they told me that they wanted me to put something on, was a record then, it wasn't tape, for a series. And I had no idea what the series was. And I did it, and then I heard, I don't know what the reason was that Joan left, but Joan left, and I took Mary Marlin over. Then in 1940, oh, dear me, they decided my salary had gotten out of hand, because each 13 weeks I got more. So they suggested I go back to my original salary. And I didn't like that thought. So I left Mary Marlin, and Betty Lou Gerson played it, and I went back east, which was really home. Mm-hmm. And then the following year it changed agencies, and Mary Marlin came to New York and to me. Then Procter & Gamble, who was the sponsor, can I say sponsors?
Sure.
Decided that they wanted to have a sort of a, well, they were trying out, testing a radio show called Woman of America. Mm-hmm. And I did that in the morning, and then Mary Marlin in the afternoon for about 2 years, I guess. And then Lipton Tea, I think it was, bought Mary Marlin, took it to CBS, 3 o'clock. We were on 3 o'clock, Mary Marlin, in New York. And they put Woman of America in Mary Marlin's spot, so I couldn't, that time, I couldn't go with Mary Marlin. And Muriel Kirkland played Mary Marlin. Then she was listening to the program one day when she wasn't on it, and Joan Blaine was playing Mary Marlin. So Joan Blaine was the first and the last.
Really,
very confusing.
It's interesting that they would change so frequently. I mean, I know it happened over a period
of
years.
Yeah, but it happened from, let's say, 1936 to probably 1946. Mm-hmm. 10 years, let's say. But Jane Crusenberry wrote it all the time.
Radio listeners would become very used to a voice in the role, and yet they switched it. And then, especially in your case, where you were another person on the program, to switch from a...
That, I thought, was terrible when it happened. I really was awfully upset, and I was tremendously fond of Joan, so it was an embarrassment to me. You know, I never would have done it, believe me, unless she hadn't wanted it. I don't know whether she...
Who knows?
Who knows? I mean, I have to leave that up in the air.
A Woman of America was... You appeared as a character by the name of Prudence...
Dane.
And this was originally a Western kind of a thing, wasn't it?
Well, yes, I'll tell you. I thought it was going to be something... See, it was during the war. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was going to be something to help the modern American woman see how the pioneer woman went through the problem. Well, they had a terrible time with it. We had, I think, 7 directors and I don't know how many writers. And they never found out exactly what was going on. In the beginning, I remember Dear Santos Ortega played my husband on the first show and died immediately. And I had
the character died.
The character died. No, poor darling, Santos died. Well, now we're being shot out there. Well, nothing was heard, I don't think. Santos was a darling man, and he was the quickest killing off of a hero in radio I know of. And then Jimmy Monks played my love, and I had the 3 children. Joan Tetzel was one of them. and Jack Manning was another. And they decided, no, she shouldn't have children. So I left them somewhere in the middle of the trek west, mm-hmm. which I didn't understand. Then we had another writer come and say, oh, she must have children. They brought them back. It was really kind of a mess, if you'll forgive me
they
for saying
follow,
so.
They didn't any logic with
no
it.
No logic at all.
Well, as a matter of fact, I think after you
then
left
they modernized
that series,
it.
Yeah, they brought it up to date,
yeah,
didn't
and
they?
Then it died.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a sad thing
they
to
made,
say.
They made Prudence
modern
a newspaper
woman,
editor.
Florence Freeman played her. I had a little difficulty with that show, I must admit. My favorite show, of course, of all times, was Against the Storm, which Sandra Michael wrote and won the Peabody. And I played over the years three different parts. I mean, you know, I'd be in New York for a time and I'd play one and then I'd play something. That was a lovely show to be on.
How long was that on, or how long were you associated with
it? About 4 years, I would say, off and on. I don't know. Time is... certain things I know, but I don't know. It seems as if I was always on Against the Storm, but I wasn't really.
Did you find
my mother was on it too? By
she
the
was.
Way. Uh-huh. Played my own mother on it.
Your mother played your mother.
My
is
mother
that
played
casting, as they say.
I don't know. But mother was an actress, and so it was quite natural for her to do it. And Sandra loved mother, so she asked her to.
Well, that's nice. Were you involved with any other so-called soap operas on?
No, I mean, I did those. Then as radio was kind of dying off, I was on a lot of them. I mean, I was on Our Gal Sunday and, oh dear, you say it, The Bible Show.
The Guiding Light?
I was on The Guiding Light, but there was the other one I was trying to think of.
Eternal Light?
No,
I'm trying to think.
No, it was a soap. Dum to dum, the story of the Bible. I can hear David Gothard now. Light of the World. No.
That's
Light of the World.
Light of the World.
Light of the World. The story of the Bible. And then I was on the night times. I mean, they used
you
to call
were very
me,
much involved in all the night times.
Well, they called me the First Lady of Inner Sanctum. I did a lot of them with Boris Karloff and Paul Lucas.
You
and
worked with the... who was it who played Raymond, the host of the
Raymond Johnson.
Raymond Edward Johnson,
Do you know how he is? He was not well the last time I saw him.
Well, the last that we had heard of him was he was very in rather poor health. And they were asking if anyone would want to write a note to him, just a card. And we mentioned it on the air to our listeners. Mm-hmm. And we heard that he had gotten dozens and dozens of cards from the folks.
Well, I
who
hope
remember,
people will continue to write him.
That's
I hope
nice.
You give his address soon
we'll
again.
We'll do it again. We'll do
Good.
It again. I want to ask you about Monty Woolley.
Oh, that you have dug up into my past, haven't you? Jiminy, well, that was a magnificent Montague with Monty and darling Pert Kelton.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was a fun thing. And Nat Hiken, you know, produced it, wrote it. We didn't have a producer in those days. He directed it and wrote it. And that
he created Bilko and a number of other things for television later, I think.
But this was the first time I think he had it. Well, I did that for 3 years. I can't believe it. No, Monty was an extraordinary man. Of course, Pert and Art Carney, you know, played all the little parts. He played Monty's father and a plumber and a football player. Anything that came along, Art played, and beautifully.
Did you ever do any doubling on the radio?
Couldn't. Because, unfortunately, if I didn't use an accent or they didn't put me on a filter on a telephone conversation, my voice, I can't change it enough.
Oh,
I think I could now. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe I'm braver or something, but in those days there was no way. I remember High Brown when he used to say, in a sanctum, he said, oh, Ann, we'll have to put you on a telephone booth or the end of the room or something, because I know it's you. I don't know why.
There were a lot of actors, though, who easily moved
from The doublers were absolutely... Everett Sloan, you know, probably was the greatest.
Well, I know why. You just said you didn't know why you couldn't double, but you have a very distinctive voice.
Well, maybe it's that.
And,
I don't know.
It's a voice that a lot of our listeners will say, oh, of course, that voice, I know. Now we have to draw the picture to go with the voice. Of course, everybody's imagination in the radio days...
They used to say I had a blonde voice. I never knew what that meant, and I never was a blonde. I was always... Well, now I'm white-haired, but I was brown, auburn.
Did you ever have an experience with fans who would tell you that you did or didn't look the way you sounded?
No. Well, you see, when I did radio, nobody ever knew me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's different now, frankly, since I've been on television and pictures. But sometimes people, I say something and they say, oh, we know who you are. And they don't maybe recognize my face right away. But the minute I speak, they put the face in the voice and out comes me.
Well, let's put the face on the voice now from television. How can someone recognize you from television? What have you been doing on television?
Well,
you were involved in it for quite a while now.
Yes, I have been. I'm very great. I did a picture. My first picture was All the King's Men, which won 54 awards in 1948. Broderick Crawford, Mercedes McCambridge, John Derrick, I mean, Joanne Drew, so many people. I'm probably leaving out Shep Strudwick. That was a fascinating experience with Bob Rawson, who really wrote, produced, and directed it from Robert Penn Warren's book. That was an exciting thing. And it's fascinating to think now I was in a classic, you know.
How's it feel to be in a classic?
I don't know. I feel just the same.
You ever watch it on the
occasionally
television?
Uh-huh. Occasionally.
Are you satisfied with your performance as you watch it now?
I was always sad to cut me out so much, but now you're used to that, you know. I did two series on television. The first one was Empire, which I did in 62 and 63.
Richard Egan.
Ryan O'Neill was my son.
Another little trivia.
And I loved Ryan. He was a darling. But that show maybe was ahead of its time. I don't know. We shot most of it in Santa Fe. Then they decided to get rid of the women, so they killed me, and I have to admit that the show flopped after that. Went to a half an hour.
Was your salary getting too high again?
No, it wasn't a question. I think it was, a male male masochism or something. I don't know. They thought that the women on the show detracted. Well, you see, what they were going to do was, it was about a woman who was me, who owned like the King's Ranch, you know, a great spread. And Richard Egan was my, what do you call him, boss, foreman. And Ryan O'Neill and Richard Egan, you see, my son wanted to have the strength, and Richard Egan wanted to run it. And I really never did run it. Because I got sort of tired of just sitting behind a coffee table, you know, or saying yes, dear, to Ryan, or all right to Richard. And we were waiting. We were in Santa Fe at the Armory where we were shooting. And I was sitting waiting to shoot, so the brass was there. And I stood up and turned a somersault, and they all fainted. And I said, you see, I can't move. But I was up in a helicopter once on the show. But it was too much of a everything was solved by a fight, Ed Begley once was in it. Because we had visiting stars all the time, and he was in an oil well blew up, and he got covered with oil, and Richard Egan got covered with oil, carrying him out, and I don't think that was the basic premise of the show. Then the other series I did was the Tim Conway Show with Tim and darling Joe Flynn. And that was a one-joke show. Me, again, owning the airport, and they were a couple of bums with a rotten old transport plane. So that didn't last very long.
I think that's one of the problems with television today. They get a one-joke
show, and they stick with it.
Or one story, you know, one-episode story, and they make a series out of it.
You can't do that.
And in radio, of course, it could go on.
Well, radio, they went, Elaine Carrington, for instance, who wrote so many shows. Jiminy, it would take her 3 weeks to get through a meal on a radio show, you know. Dinner would go on forever instead of who came.
Did you enjoy working on the radio show?
Oh, sure, I loved it. I love to work. I mean, I did it this winter in Emergency, which was not on not too long ago, and I love doing that show. And those guys who play the paramedics are just wonderful. So I adore to work, let me put it that way. I feel sometimes if I were hanging on now by my fingernails, because there are so few parts for women my age, the age I'm at now, which is too bad, but I suppose it's part of the game. I don't know.
You are working with
regularity. Yeah, I'm working. Sure, I've done commercials. I did a police story.
Which commercials have you done?
Well, now, I did one for turkey, honeysuckle turkey. That was a few years
ago.
That
must be West Coast, huh?
No, it went all over the country.
Honeysuckle turkey?
Honeysuckle turkey.
That's a national... Oh, okay.
Yeah, really it is. I think it comes from the East, really. Then I did the one that got me the most money, which is very frankly why anybody does it, commercial, was Haley's M.O. And I made really a nice little pot of money out of that one. That ran about a year and a half. And I think, but you're never sure, you know, in this crazy bit. Oh, I tell you one that I did, which makes everybody hysterical. I did a jockey tennis short. See, I knew you'd laugh. See, I didn't wear them. I gave. I gave.
Well, we don't know.
Trophy.
I mean, who was it? Wasn't it Joe Namath who wore the
silk panty?
The
yeah, well, I think he's got better legs than I have. But that was on sort of like for a week, biggie, you know, and then boom. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened to that one. Now I may have. I say may have because it hasn't started yet. Oh, great, a camera, Polaroid.
Oh, well, that's a good one.
That ought to be a very good one.
Coming up for the holidays and all of that stuff.
Well, I don't
know.
We took we did it sitting in a hay wagon.
Oh.
But the hay wasn't loose. It was in bales. And they didn't put a blanket on the bale that I was sitting on. And I was spent a rather miserable time.
Well, you could just be glad you weren't wearing the jockey.
on the bale.
On the bale.
But I don't know. It's it used to make me kind of mad when people came up and said, oh, we saw you on a commercial. And I thought, gee, I've been in this business for umpty 9 years, and they remember me for a commercial. But I think it's the constant repetition.
It's the exposure.
Yeah.
It's on and on and on. You know. But some, you know, a lasting... a performance, or a good performance, or a bad performance for that matter, on a film, on a TV film, or a motion picture, lasts forever. And is that ever, you ever consider that, you know?
I know, it's kind of frightening.
25, 100 years from now,
it's frightening because you think you did something that wasn't really very good, and it's apt to come back and haunt you.
No, think of it this way. You've done something that was good, and that because of the media... because of the medium, the film, that what you did that was so good will last forever. You know?
Well, that's a very nice way to put it.
Would be nice.
I always think, wouldn't it be an idea of just awfulness if you had to go to the place where all the dead TV and radio shows go? I mean, where do they go? Do they just disappear into space, or are there a little nook up there, somewhere near Mars, and all of them are up there, and as a penance, you have to go up and stay with them?
Oh, I wish we could tune in, you know, get an old Super Heterodyne out again and tune in to some of those once in a while.
You know, Les Tremaine and I were talking the other day, because he followed Don Ameche on Grand Hotel, and he said, have you got a tape of or a record of Grand Hotel? And no one ever has. I mean, it just seems to have disappeared.
No, I've never.
Have you ever heard of one?
I'm a collector of the shows, and I've never heard of Grand Hotel.
No, I never have either. Because,
yeah.
You see, then, in those days, they didn't make acetates. I directed shows in Chicago, and I directed Judy and Jane in a show called Hope Alden's Romance, and they were done at that time on wax. You know, the engineer ran this and had a great, huge, like a slab of wax, and we recorded onto that. Then it went somewhere, and it came back as this heavy acetate.
I hope no one made a mistake on that as they were going along.
You had to start all over again.
From the top again.
You know, one thing I remember so clearly, there was supposed to be a hospital door in one of the shows, and I didn't want to click, you know, because they don't click. They go whoosh. So we found out that we could wave a blanket in front of the mic, and it sounded whoosh, which would be a hospital door, and it waved a little needle right off of the wax.
Oh.
And we had to do the script or show all over again.
Did you have many problems with things like that going wrong in the radio days?
Well, there's the one that I don't think I ever told anyone this before. I don't know whether anybody else has. It was supposed to be, it was on Grand Hotel. And Don Ameche and I were in a carriage after World War I. It was a, would you say, period piece? And we were going along. I think we couldn't get married for some reason. He had a wife, or I had a husband, or no head, or I don't know. And we're clopping along in this carriage, and along came an explosion, you see, and that was the end of us. And they had three sound effects men, which in those days was quite something. One on a record to make rumble, rumble, rumble. One on timpani to do it. And then a guy right in front of the mic, close up, with strawberry boxes to crunch it. So, you know, big, terrific sound effect. And that was the end of the show. They all watched each other to see who was going to do it first, and they never did it. There wasn't a sound. Nobody knew. I mean, what happened to you on that show? It was really awful.
The carriage blew up and
nothing. The Paris blew up with not a sound. That was a strange one. I've had funny. Well, sure, everybody has funny experiences like that. Once I did a television serial in New York. It was called Follow Your Heart, and an actress on it, I've forgotten her name. Let's say anyhow, decided she would. We had a long scene where she had to question me. I've forgotten what it was all about. And she was the boss lady. She was sort of running the act, you know. She'd say, now you sit here, and the director was sort of just standing around, so I did whatever she said. We got on the air, and she looked at me and said, I'm up. And her eyes had that awful, glassy, blank look. And I thought, oh, Lord, love us. So I tried to bring her back, you know, and said, you mean you want to ask me if blah, blah, blah. And she said, answer that. And I thought, oh, we're over that. Then she went again, and I watched out of the corner of my eye where they took her camera out, and they had the camera right on me, and she never opened her mouth. And I had to do one of those, oh, this is what you think that you want to ask. Oh, I almost died with that one. That was awful. That was like a nightmare.
That was live.
That was live, absolutely live. And when I walked, the thing was over, I walked out, and I remember Harry Holcomb was standing right there, and I just collapsed on it. I mean, my legs just gave way. It was all terrible. And then I did a Studio One once, and there was a little man who had to finish up the whole show. He was the only one who knew the answer. It wasn't a very good show. And he was basically an opera star. And he drove us all crazy because he hummed all the time, you know, constantly. And he hadn't been there very much, because it was only one little speech, you see, to wrap up the show. And we got to that one little speech, and he had that look. And no one else could say a word because nobody else knew it. And the cameramen, you know, those live cameramen were especially wonderful, panned down to his briefcase, trying to give him the line, and he couldn't get it. And if the show went off the air with no solution, that was live.
And then the mail comes in.
So what was the matter? How did it end? Who did it?
How do they resolve something like that? Did they go on next week and tell the end of it?
Well, they couldn't say what happened. No, I don't think it was ever resolved.
Just forget about it.
One of those unfinished symphonies, best forgotten.
What's ahead for Ann Seymour now?
Well, Ann Seymour doesn't know.
Ann Seymour?
No, she plays it by ear. I have lovely agents, and I love working. When I go to commercials now, auditions, I call it seeing my friends so I don't get uptight. Because I always see people I know, you know. Mm-hmm. We're all for the same thing. We could all play the same part, but we don't look right. Like Grandma Moses is the idea of a grandmother very often for television. But thank goodness, I'm a very busy woman. And a very happy woman, and I love it out here.
Well, you're lovely out here, and it's nice to be here and to share these memories with you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
It was very sweet of you to ask me. To come.
Our pleasure.
Or me to ask you, or you to ask. Well, anyway, thank you for coming, Chuck.
Or are you going to lower your salary now?
Again?
Again.
Oh!
Now, don't touch that dial, because just as we turned off our tape recorder, Ann Seymour said...
Ann Seymour said, because she feels very deeply about this, that something must be done about the violence on television, the reruns that begin in February and end in, like, November, and the family hour, which is such a piece of nonsense. And if you feel, as I do, that there must be less reruns, that the prime time and the family hour must be straightened out, must not be run by the FCC, who doesn't seem to be doing anything about it, I wish you'd write to whomever you feel is responsible. You can write the FCC, you can write to Washington, you can write to the president, whoever we get, and say, please do something about this. It's bad, because it's giving television an image that it really hasn't got, and the actors are absolutely helpless in this. It's the networks. And with that, Chuck, I thank you.
No, well, let me ask a question about this, Ann. We were saying earlier in our conversation about how the sponsors really maintained the control over the radio shows in those days. And that, what really happened, the sponsor, or the agency on behalf of the sponsor, negotiated with the network for the time, and the agency produced and delivered the show to the network, even though maybe the show was actually... done on network property.
And it was very
studios.
Often directed by networks and produced by
but
the network.
But it was owned and operated by the agency for
and
the sponsor.
You're right, and the sponsor owned the show.
Now today, and they used to say in those days, if we could get control away from the sponsors, we'd have much better programming.
I know.
Now today, the networks
it's a monopoly,
control
really.
Everything, see?
It's
and
a monopoly.
The sponsor
Let's
has
face
no
it.
Identification with the show.
And the agencies don't really.
No,
it's
right.
It's all the sponsor. And if you say, I want a show and I'd like to have a soap as a sponsor, you could end up with, I'm trying to think of something as far from soap as possible, whipped cream.
Mm-hmm.
And you have no control at all. And I do think that there are many wonderful men and women who are in the network business, but I do think that somehow or other something has got to be straightened out on this. It cannot go on as a cartel and a monopoly, because it's not fair to the American people.
Well, I know that by February we're not ready for reruns.
Of course not. Do you know, I think the most exciting, and this is a terrible thing for me to say, the thing that I've seen in ages, was of the Olympics. I think they were beautifully done by ABC, and I watched them. I got so fond of every single one of them.
It was nice to see someone diving, and then you see him a second time, and a nice third shot at
And the shots were beautiful. And Jim, the man who was the...
McKay.
I've fallen madly in love with him. Couldn't remember his name. I call him Jim. No, I really mean that. But this was a beautiful, exciting, clean, lovely... emotional. When it was over, I wept and thought, oh dear me, now I have nothing to look forward to on television.
Right.
I think that the educational channel is Upstairs Downstairs was by far my favorite show. But the public, the listeners, must do something about it. We've done all we can do. And I'm deeply grateful that you let me say this.
Oh, well, we're glad that, you know, have to hear what someone who has the credentials to say it.
Well, I've seen it all the way along, you know. When I was a little girl, there wasn't any even a radio set, for heaven's sakes. And look how it's developed. And I think electronically and scientifically, it's marvelous. But we've got to give them better. And I think that the public wants better. I won't go to shows that are just chases and shooting and blood. I call them instant blood ick.
Yeah. Well, today, if you have a void in the story, you know, if you do a...
Sure, fight.
You know,
stab someone.
Give us another murder and send some more cars careening over the side of another car, and that's about it.
I know. It's in some movies, for instance, All the President's Men, I adored. I think that was a great picture. I couldn't bear The Omen. I called it a continuation of The Exorcist, which I think was disgusting. And I'm not speaking just of morals at all. I'm saying what I was... made to look at, except I didn't. I'm one of the duckers. You know, I duck. Like in The Towering Inferno, I duck.
Well, you didn't.
And I wouldn't go to Jaws because I love the ocean too much. So, I mean, I sound like an awful old bat, don't I? I don't mean it that way at all.
Well, I think everybody has a right to speak their mind, and it's nice to have you speak yours on our show.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Ann Seymour.